You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, the Higgs goes to Ghana, and we find out what's next for the LHC.
Of course, it seems to walk like a Higgs, it seems to talk like a Higgs if you look at the properties, but there still has to be action in it done. Is it, first of all, a Higgs, and even more, if it is the Higgs?
Time gives away to shape as Julian Barber talks quantum gravity and consciousness.
Now, maybe consciousness is tied to the way the wave function of the universe is behaving in the vicinity.
And future memories, how the brain uses yesterday to envisage tomorrow.
So when we think about ourselves in time, it seems as though we may be calling upon a single core capacity in order to either go backwards or forwards in time.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Welcome to the FQXI podcast. Before we get started, a very quick congratulations to FQXI members Alan Guth and Andre Linde. The cosmologists behind inflation theory are among 9 researchers to have just been awarded the new Fundamental Physics Prize, established by Yuri Milner.
Yes, they've won $3 million each, which is not to be sniffed at.
We didn't have time to chat with them for this edition, but visit the site www.fqxi.org/community for articles about their research and more about the award.
And in the meantime, if you want to know more about inflation, listen to our interview with Hiranya Pyrrhus in June at www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Now, Zia, have you ever played Name That Tune? Listen to this and tell me what you think it is.
Is it our new FQXI jingle?
No, it's actually the Higgs boson. Put to music. On July 4th, as some of you may have heard, physicists on the ATLAS and CMS experiments at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva announced the discovery of a Higgs-like particle. The Higgs, which was predicted to exist as part of the mechanism that gives elementary particles mass, has been the main focus of the LHC hunt since the accelerator started up. Now, data from ATLAS has been sonified by Domenico Vicinanza at Dante as the delivery of advanced network technology to Europe in Cambridge, UK, along with Maria Paola Sorrentino of the Astra Project, also in Cambridge, and Giuseppe La Rocca of INFN Catania. That's what you heard, and the Higgs appears about 3.5 seconds into the recording.
And very pretty it sounds too. Which brings me to a chat I had with particle physicist Albert Dirac from the CMS experiment. We talked about what the Higgs discovery means for alternative models of physics, such as supersymmetry, and the hunt for extra dimensions. And we also talked about what it felt like to be at the LHC in the run-up to the announcement. Speaking to me from Ghana, Dirac began by telling me about CERN's efforts to cash in on the global excitement surrounding the Higgs. He was out there encouraging students in Africa to take up science, engineering, and, of course, particle physics.
Particle physics by itself is an excellent training ground for even more global or more general type of interest further on. It could be in engineering, it could be in microelectronics and computing. And I would imagine that many of the people which would be eventually interested in that here would not necessarily just follow the road of particle physics, but would look at it as a launching pad or so to get into contact with newest technologies and newest developments. So I see it more as a catalyzer. Now, everywhere in the world there are brilliant minds around which just must be given the right opportunities to develop. And I think we will also discover good African physicists which will play a role in particle physics because they're interested in that. And with that kind of connection, may well hook on to, for example, the CERN program and by visiting us first and then, you know, starting something in the country they're coming from and be a part of this science adventure as well.
Of course, you know, the Higgs discovery was just met with so much excitement around the world. Were you surprised by that, or were you expecting that level of excitement?
I was completely baffled by the media and general public interest in this phenomenon, and it looked like everybody, you know, wanted to be part of it. And I have seen the discovery from down under, that is from Australia, where we had this big conference, which happened actually at that time, and for which essentially we were sort of getting the results together to be able to present them. And it was absolutely amazing. Like, you know, we were asked to, you know, give interviews on television and things like that, mostly trying to explain what it actually is that we have discovered.
Well, so then I should ask you, what is it that you've actually discovered? We hear about the Higgs field, we hear about the Higgs boson, we've been told that they give the particles mass. Do you have an explanation for how that all comes about?
In the very beginning of the universe, energies were very high, particles were effectively massless, and they were zapping around with the speed of light. If the universe would have continued that way, there's no way that matter could be found with particles just zapping around with the speed of light. So at some point, some phase transition happened where this, what we think and believe now is the Higgs field, that indeed provoked that, and that gave resistance to particles. It slowed them down. It gave them mass. Mass is resistance to the velocity which you have. Now, by discovering this mechanism, we actually start to understand how we came about.
So we all listened to this announcement from the outside, but what was happening in the run-up to the announcement at CERN? Can you tell us about how, you know, at what point you realized that you were able to go forward and make a big announcement? And how long did you have to sort of keep that quiet? And how was it difficult to keep that quiet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting scientific as well as sociologic question, I would say, because, you know, these collaborations that I'm working in, there are two big experiments, each of them having more than 3,000 people in the experiment, scientists. So what happened is, historically, that around about December last year, when we looked at the data, both experiments saw a glimpse of sort of popping up of the Higgs signal in the data. It was not enough in any way to make a firm conclusion, but it was something hopeful, something saying, yeah, something is probably growing there. So what we decided in the CMS experiment then at that point was, good, let's, you know, accumulate as much data as we can for this checkpoint, which was the conference which happened in Australia. And let's not look at the data. Let's do the analysis, what you call, in a blinded way. So you look at everything around the signal, but not at the signal itself. You do not want to optimize the analysis for making that signal grow. You want to let it grow by itself without looking at it. And so we did that. And so we had the checkpoint, which was like 2.5 weeks before that conference started, that we, what we call, opened the box. We unveiled what was really sitting in there. And this was a very, very dramatic meeting which we had in our collaboration. This was a room where, I mean, I would say that there were twice as many people in there as there were seats. There were lots of people, hundreds, on video conferencing following that. We did all measures to make it not possible to disperse this information afterwards. And then we looked at the results. And at that point, and I still remember that was on the 15th of June, around 3 o'clock, I knew we had a discovery. In fact, the 600-700 people following that at the same time with us knew at this point we had a discovery. And of course, then we had to sit on it for 2 weeks, not talk about it, make sure nothing leaks out at any other site. I'm sure the other experiment was in a similar situation. I mean, seeing it now, what they had. And these were very, you know, very tense days, let's say.
And now let's talk about the actual result itself. You know, there's a lot of excitement over what the mass of the Higgs would be. And why couldn't theoretical physicists predict one single value for the mass of the Higgs and just tell everybody, go and look there?
Because that is actually, in the theory, there is nothing that constrains that mass to be at a certain value. Once you have that mass, you can predict all the other properties of the Higgs. And so now that we have the mass within a GeV or 2 GeV or so, we can predict all couplings it may have to other kind of particles. The mass is extremely important because the mass really determines, for example, viability of certain theories. Supersymmetry, they would have preferred like 115 to 120 rather than 125.
So one question that's come in related to that from quite a few of the readers of the site and the listeners on the podcast is that if you didn't know what the mass of the Higgs should have been, how do you know that you have found the Higgs and not some other particle, some kind of imposter?
Yes, right. We are saying we found the Higgs-like particle. We know pretty much it's a boson because of the particles it decays in. It decays, for example, in 2 photons, 2 Zs, and so forth. That's what you could expect a boson to be doing. We know that since it decays into 2 photons, that it's not a vector type of particle. So it's most likely a scalar type of particle. And a scalar type of particle, a fundamental scalar, we haven't actually seen yet, ever. This is the first ever fundamental scalar we see in nature, and that makes it very exciting. And that's exactly what a Higgs should be. But we call it Higgs-like because, yes, we want to stay a little careful. Of course, it seems to walk like a Higgs. It seems to talk like a Higgs if you look at the properties. But we still have to really actually pin it down. Is it, first of all, a Higgs, and even more, if it is the Higgs? In the Higgs, I mean the particle which Peter Higgs had in mind when he wrote theories which were connected to what we call now the standard model.
And so when you're talking about pinning down its properties, what sort of things will you now be trying to look at?
Well, most important are going to be its quantum numbers. So what the state of that particle is. And technically that's called, is it the scalar indeed, or is it the pseudoscalar, or something else, which we don't believe, but among the first two which I mentioned, this is still open. And we look at, by really looking at many of these decays of these particles, and we need more of the decays than what we have so far, and looking in what they call angular distributions. So we're going to be able to say something on these quantum numbers, technically also called the spin of that particle, or the spin parity of that particle. The other thing we're going to be looking for, or measuring actually, is how often does that particle decay in other different particle species? For example, how often does it decay in 2 photons? How often does it decay in 2 B quarks? And compare that with, as I said, everything we can now calculate because we have the mass, so we can predict exactly in the standard model and in other models what the, for example, the ratio of these 2 decay modes should be.
And so you started to talk about some of the different models, the standard model. You're talking about supersymmetry. Can you just expand a little bit more on what supersymmetry is and why people are looking for evidence for it and what exactly this result means for that theory?
So supersymmetry is an idea that's propagated quite a while back, over 20 years ago, that nature may have another symmetry, which we haven't seen evidence for, but maybe there, to help us understanding why the universe is so stable the way it is. And that predicts that for each particle that we know now, each elementary particle, quarks, leptons, or the bosons which we are having as elementary particles, that there are partners, so-called super partners, which are generally much more heavy than the original particles because we haven't seen them yet, and which have a different quantum number so that, in fact, by the existence of these particles, we can stabilize a lot of things in the theory. So it's enormously attractive from that point of view that could be something that would happen in nature. And then, for example, also string theories typically need supersymmetry in there to make it work. So there's, from that point in the theoretical community, a lot of belief that this could be the right path. But of course, it's not the only thing people are working on. From the practical side, if indeed supersymmetry would exist, that could help us to explain dark matter, for example, which is one of the mysteries still around us, that we know that most of the matter around which we see gravitationally in the universe seems to be of a different kind than the one we, you know, from our daily life. Now, as for the Higgs, that has a lot to tell on this supersymmetry. For example, the Higgs mass of 125 GeV is a little uncomfortable for supersymmetries. It's on the high side. It's still possible for supersymmetry to encompass that, but it squeezes out a lot of the possible phase space of where these models could live. And the Higgs itself, as a particle, in a supersymmetric environment, will not be exactly the same as a standard model Higgs. And measuring deviations or differences with what we expect a standard model Higgs to be in the properties can tell us also directly what kind of supersymmetry we're dealing with and if supersymmetry exists altogether.
And has the finding already helped you rule out any other models? I've been reading about Technicolor.
Yeah.
What's that model?
Well, there are models that don't have a Higgs or don't want a Higgs or don't need a Higgs. And so particularly in Technicolor, Higgs has no particular role whatsoever. They have a different type of mechanism that does what in the standard model the Higgs is doing. So finding a Higgs is, of course, a killing stroke to the so-called Higgsless models. Models that, you know, said that a Higgs doesn't exist and we do it in a different way. But it's certain that the bets on these models, the so-called Higgsless models, have gone down quite a bit in the last weeks.
And what about some of the other things that we've been very excited about possibly finding at the LHC? So things like extra dimensions, things like mini black holes. You know, does this result have any implications for how likely we are to find these things, or is it completely unrelated?
Extra dimension models are still particularly viable. Again, there are also extra dimension models which were speculating that the mass generation mechanism came in a different way than by the Higgs. Well, these, of course, are not so favorable at the moment anymore. But most of these models do need a Higgs of some sort to do that part of the job.
You've outlined, you know, a number of things that you're going to be looking for now.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to be the sort of the time frame, you know, until the next big announcement, do you think?
I wish I knew. First of all, the other things which you mentioned, we are looking for those already. In parallel, we are 3,000 people, and I said 700 work on the Higgs, well, there's still over 1,000 working on other subjects, like supersymmetry searches, like extra dimension searches, like even alternative type of new physics model searches, and they will be ongoing. Now, the accelerator runs till the end of the year. We collect data, and then we have a data sample, very good for studying the Higgs particle, and as much as we can go for studying other new effects which are all on our checklist. Whether we will see something there or not, you know, nature knows, I don't know. We will see if any day with what we are doing, we are pushing further in new regimes. You know, we boldly go where no man has gone before, essentially. So any day something can happen, something can drop out, and that, of course, will be then the next big thing to talk about. What I can say is I think that by the end of the year, beginning next year, we're going to have the sum up of our understanding then of that Higgs particle. So it may well be that the next big announcement is going to come from there, saying that, you know, maybe we found that it's not the Higgs particle, but a Higgs particle with different properties. That would be a big thing too.
Thank you to Albert de Roerck there for keeping us up to date with the Higgs search. You can listen to an extended version of that interview on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, in which Albert talks in more detail about what the findings mean for physics, about the politics behind the timing of the announcement, and about his unexpected celebrity status. With each passing day, that Higgs signal seems to be getting stronger. It's now at the 5.9 sigma level, which means there's only a 1 in 550 million chance that the result is just a fluke.
Dirac described how it was a little surprising to find that the mass of the Higgs is around 126 GeV, which is a little heavier than supersymmetry models might have wanted. But did you know that the late great science fiction author Douglas Adams predicted that mass in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy way back in the 1970s?
It's a brilliant book and a brilliant radio show, but you'll have to elaborate there a bit. I don't remember it mentioning the Higgs mass.
Well, according to The Hitchhiker's Guide, the meaning of life, the universe, and everything is 42. And life is 42 plus the universe is 42 plus everything, 42, equals
126, the Higgs mass.
That's right. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Actually, thank you to @HitchhikersLive on Twitter for that joke. You can also follow us on Twitter @FQXI, though our jokes aren't as good.
You know what else I learned from Hitchhikers? Time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so. That's a quote that rings clear bells with physicist Julian Barber, who has long claimed that time is not fundamental, though I'm not sure about his thoughts on lunch. Have you ever had lunch with Julian Barber, by the way?
Yes, many times.
All right, so he doesn't think it's an illusion then, I guess.
No, he's very strict about lunch.
Right, okay. With a bit of help from FQXI, Barber has produced a video about his latest ideas, which you can find on the website www.fqxi.org/community. He's also got a blog post up and is very kindly taking questions about a theory of shape dynamics that he's developing, which could lead us to a theory of quantum gravity, uniting general relativity and quantum mechanics. I spoke to him about his research, beginning with his belief that time does not exist.
The idea about time is that it really cannot be a fundamental part of the universe, that it must somehow either derive from change. Psychologically, we wouldn't be aware of the passage of time if what we perceive doesn't change. I'm looking out of the window now and the leaves on the walnut tree are blowing in the wind. And that tells me things are changing. And Ernst Mach said it's utterly impossible to measure the changes of things by time. Much rather, time is an abstraction at which we arrive from the changes of things. And that has very far-reaching consequences and goes a long way to explain the structure of Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Why is that? Why does having this picture in which time is not fundamental, how does that help us understand general relativity? Because when we think about general relativity, we think about space-time.
Yes, a very important discovery that was made at the end of the 1950s in this country by the great British physicist Paul Dirac, and in the United States by three physicists, Arnavit, Deser, and Misner. And what they did was not to look at general relativity as a theory of space-time given once and for all. This is the famous block universe picture in which time looks as if it's more or less exactly the same as space. Instead, they tried to understand the general relativity as a dynamical theory. The key concept in Einstein's original formulation is the metric of four-dimensional space-time, so that when they started out on this work, particularly Dirac, he expected that as you moved in the time direction through space-time, what you would find would be the complete four-dimensional metric of space-time changing. But what he discovered is that it's not that way at all. What is actually happening is that it's not the four-dimensional metric which is changing. It's three-dimensional geometry at each instant of time. So that was, for Dirac, was a very remarkable discovery, and he was so impressed it led him to question whether four-dimensional symmetry is a fundamental feature of the physical world. And he expressed that sentiment in one single sentence, which I read by chance back in the autumn of 1963, and it sparked whole lot of thinking on my part, particularly what on earth is time, and it completely changed my whole life. There is another aspect of time which I see as what I call time capsules, which is you can also find time sitting within static configurations. This you see in the Earth, where the geologists looked at the structure of rocks and things like that, and they came to the conclusion that you could only explain this static structure of the world by assuming that it was the outcome of an immensely long process that had taken place in time in accordance with laws. And that's all in a static configuration. So those are two ways that time are manifested. And I think that the latter possibility through what I call time capsules is very profoundly related to this issue of why time seems to have a direction.
This time capsule way of thinking about things helps us understand why time appears to have a direction. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
When you come to try and treat general relativity as a quantum mechanical theory, you get the remarkable thing which is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is what one hopes will describe the quantum mechanics of the universe. One thing it seems to suggest is that time will play no part at all in the quantum mechanics of a closed universe. That caused a great deal of surprise and is known as the problem of time. Time seems to disappear. So what you have in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, it suggests that the only thing that exists are static, unchanging configurations of the universe. So where on earth does the sensation of time come from? Then, just over 20 years ago, it occurred to me that configurations can be very special. I mean, you can throw down 100 black dots on a bit of paper in a totally random way and it means nothing. But a cartoonist can make a very interesting story out of 100 black dots if they're arranged appropriately on the page. And this led me to the idea of time capsules and the realization that we find them all over the universe. They're everywhere. We find these very special structures, which we interpret them at the moment as having arisen dynamically through time and surviving that process of evolution as some record of what has gone before. But it occurred to me that maybe you can eliminate that sort of process happening through time and say, well, they just are created by a timeless quantum mechanics. And then comes a very significant thing, I believe, which is that configurations are all different. Every single configuration that the universe can have is different. So you have a space of configurations of the universe, or I prefer to think of it as a space of the possible shapes of the universe. And it is very asymmetrical. Every shape space, every way that you can think about the possible shapes of the universe and consider all of the possible shapes, there's always one shape which is uniquely distinguished. It's the shape which is more uniform than any other shape. You see this very well if you just had a universe that consisted of three particles in Euclidean space, then in any instant, they would form a triangle. That's the shape of the universe in that instant. And there is a uniquely distinguished shape of triangles, and that's the equilateral triangle. Now, as soon as you start putting in more particles, then you get a very, very rich structure of shape space. And certainly with particles, there's a unique way of characterizing how complicated they are. And the complexity of these shapes can grow without limit. And there's no question that we find time capsules all around us. The most amazing thing about the universe is the extraordinary consistency of the story it tells. We have this idea of a Big Bang, which, by the way, seems to have been very uniform, which I think is very suggestive. And then we find it's been getting ever more complicated structures.
I have a philosophical question about your conception of time. When we try to think about the fact that people perceive time as flowing and try and square that with your conception that we have static configurations and time comes out of arranging these configurations, Does that mean in this picture that our minds or our consciousness transcends those configurations and can somehow experience and interpret multiple configurations? Or does that mean that they're almost separate consciousnesses existing within each snapshot, and each of those at some instant can only experience what's happening in that instance, and then are looking at that, the sort of the shapes and the configurations, and inferring what must have happened in the past from within?
Now, in my book, The End of Time, I conjectured that everything is all in one single brain configuration, so that my sense of motion comes from consciousness being fed by everything that is in one single brain configuration. It's different in any instant, but it's always just one. Now, more recently, I've been wondering whether there might be alternative ways that somehow or other the brain has access to more than one configuration, or also is attuned to the specifically quantum aspects. In quantum gravity, one postulates the existence of what is called the wave function of the universe. Now, maybe consciousness is not only tied to the actual an instantaneous configuration, but also to the way the wave function of the universe is behaving in the vicinity of this configuration. So, but this is still very tentative on my part.
So this brings us on to your work on shape dynamics. Can you just sort of contrast it with the way that people usually handle Einstein's general relativity? They don't tend to think so much in terms of shape. What do they do?
Either they think in terms of space-time as a complete entity, then if they're thinking of gravity as being something which is about dynamical evolution, then they think of it in terms of what is called superspace. Now, the reason for that is because in general relativity, as it's normally formulated, you have relativity of simultaneity. What do you mean by simultaneity is it's a slice through space-time. It's a bit like taking a loaf of bread and cutting it in half with a sharp knife, but not cutting it cleanly at right angles to the line of the loaf, but in some sort of curvy manner. Now, each of those slices is really a three-dimensional geometry. And what that means is that they can never really deal with pure shapes. They're always dealing with a mixture of shape and distance. After all, let's go back to a triangle. A triangle has a shape, which is defined by its angles, and those are dimensionless numbers. They don't depend on any particular unit. And then a triangle has a size. And that depends upon you having some external measuring ruler to measure it by. And I find that very, very suspicious if we're thinking about the whole universe. So what shape dynamics does is actually, it's very drastic, but it comes out very nicely out of first principles that only relative quantities should count. What we find is that we do recover Einstein's space-time, but we recover it with an absolutely rigorous rule that you can only cut it, so to speak, at right angles to the long direction of the loaf. So we're always cutting space-time properly so that we could make decent pieces of toast.
Now, you mentioned that you have successfully reproduced general relativity. And obviously, general relativity has been remarkably successful at explaining the motions of planets. So why do we need to look at it in another way, to look at it in terms of shape?
As a four-dimensional space-time theory at the level of classical physics, Einstein's original formulation is incredibly beautiful and economic. When you try and quantize it, it becomes an absolute nightmare. There are problems to do with divergences. It doesn't seem to make mathematical sense in that sense. But there's also this huge conceptual problem of what on earth is it about? Now, the potentially great advantage of shape dynamics is that it says absolutely unambiguously what gravity is about. It's about the change of shapes, or it's about probabilities for shapes of the universe.
Now, I understand that some of your collaborators have been looking at quantum gravity, I guess in some detail. Are you encouraged by their results so far?
I would say that they've made the case for shape dynamics more plausible. I think the most promising one is work being done by Tim Koslovsky and Enrique Gomez, who've published several papers together. And they initially published another paper with Sean Gribb, where they put shape dynamics in a particularly convenient form for the study of quantum phenomena. It's a sort of cleanly formulated gauge theory, and gauge theory has always been very, very helpful and useful in making progress in physics. That's the standard model is all about gauge theories. But I don't think this is going to happen quickly, because quantum gravity is an immensely difficult task. But at least we have a clear direction in which to go, which I would say has not hitherto existed.
That was Julian Barber explaining why shape is more real than time. There's an extended version of that interview on the site, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, in which he describes other advantages of his model and his inspiration, explains his ideas on time in more detail, and describes efforts by his collaborators to come up with a theory of doubly general relativity. You'll also find links to videos featuring Julian's work, his book, and his FQXI blog, where he welcomes questions about shape dynamics and the illusion of time.
Ideas on how the brain might perceive a flow of time lead us firmly into the territory of neuropsychology. But Washington University's Kathleen McDermott is waiting there to meet us. She studies how people can imagine possible future scenarios and how the brain processes involved are similar to those we use when we remember the past. Speaking at the FQXI interdisciplinary meeting on the nature of time, McDermott explained her brain imaging experiments to Zia and how they help her to understand mental time travel.
Well, mental time travel is a term that Endel Tolving has been using to describe how we both remember events in our past and how we can also envision potential future events as they might unfold in the future.
So those are two very different experiences. I mean, I can always tell the difference between whether I'm sort of remembering something from the past or whether I'm trying to imagine something that's going to happen in the future. How do you sort of quantify that difference? How have you been trying to do that experimentally?
Well, we use functional magnetic resonance imaging, or functional MRI, to look at people's brains as they're both trying to remember events from their past and envision potential events that could unfold in the future.
Before you started your experiment, what results did you expect to find?
Well, we expected to find regions that were preferentially active both for remembering and for envisioning the future. In our first study, we had 21 healthy young adults undergoing brain scans while they used a cue, like birthday party, to either remember a specific event in their personal past, to envision a potential event in their future, or to think about another person engaged in such an event. And then we just compared activity amongst the three conditions, and we showed that there's these profound similarities between remembering ourselves in the past and envisioning in the future. Regions that are important for remembering are equally active when we envision potential future scenarios. So when we think about ourselves in time, it seems as though we may be calling upon a single core capacity in order to either go backwards or forwards in time.
So what does that mean in terms of the way we sort of process or plan or think about the future compared with when we think about the past?
Well, what seems to happen is that we call upon our memories in order to piece together potential future episodes. And this fits really well with the neuropsychological literature, which started all this thinking, in which it was observed by Endel Tolving that a patient named KC, not only can he not remember a single episode from his entire life, but he also cannot envision himself in the future, in any kind of personal event that might take place with himself in the future. He just completely draws a blank, and he says it's the same sort of blankness as when he's trying to recollect but cannot.
So people who have lost their past memory have difficulty imagining what the future might be like. So as a psychologist, how do you feel about the question of whether or not time is real or is an illusion, from what you've seen?
Well, subjective time is very real. So as you mentioned, that we can readily distinguish between cases in which we're remembering or envisioning the future. And with that in mind, it's hard for me to think about the possibility that time is actually not real, although this meeting has been particularly interesting and opening my eyes to a number of questions that I had never even pondered.
That was Kathleen McDermott chatting to Zia.
That's all we have time for today. You can try to envisage what our next edition might be about based on your memories of this one. And email us your ideas at podcast@fqxi.org. In the meantime, here's some Higgs boson music to play us out.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster. Thank you.